mommy says I'm a miracle.
Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we speak with Joe Iconis. We also review Matilda, Motown the Musical, the New York Pots tribute to Stephen Schwartz, and another Madea. So please stay tuned.
My daddy says I'm your special little soldier. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, nothing will change. Even if you're little, you can do a lot. You must let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top of you, it is what we're saying.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 14th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being the Broadway MVPs 1960 to 2010, the most valuable players of the past 50 seasons. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Also, I hear that we're going to see the new book is going to be coming soon. What's the published date of that new book?
May 28th. Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks, dealing with Gypsy, Follies, West Side Story, and other musicals that did not win Best Musical Tony.
So we're just about 6 weeks away from that. We're looking forward to that. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at talkinbroadway.com, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's a photographer whose work can be seen at foulspotphoto.com and many other places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. By the way, I'm working on a book on Sweeney Todd. Did I mention this?
Oh, terrific. Good for you. That's great.
And it's, I think you'll find this story amusing. About 9 a.m. yesterday, I got a call, and I said hello. And I heard, hello, is this Michael? And then, yes. Who's this? This is Len Carew. Because I had approached through his agent about speaking to him to get some quotes. And I didn't know he was going to be calling me at home. But there he was. So that was pretty exciting.
Len is great.
Yes, he is.
Michael, did you know that I don't know what I was, but I was involved in some way in a 25th anniversary of Sweeney Todd on the West End. And Len was there, and Len did it, and Davis Gaines did Anthony, and Judy Kay did Mrs. Lovett. It was really a wonderful production.
Oh, so, yeah. I'm not sure I did know you were involved in it.
Yeah, we'll chat offline about that. But okay. Len can tell you some great stories about that. Some very full stories. All right, so with us this morning, we have a special guest, Joe Iconis. Joe is a writer and performer, and he also bills himself as a creature of Manhattan and can be frequently spotted banging away on a dirty old piano. Broadway lovers will know Joe as a composer and a lyricist, book writer. He's authored a bunch of musicals. One is called The Blood Song of Love, also The Black Suits, Rewrite, Plant That Eight Dirty Socks, and We the People. So, Joe, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You have coming up this week, in fact, starting tomorrow, you're going to be at 54 Below doing your show, and it's with your family, it says, but I have a feeling it's a bunch of guys you play with, right?
It's it is. It's sort of a collective of artists that I frequently collaborate with, and it sort of feels like it's in between a rock band and a cabaret or something.
Well, that's a good feel. You know, rock bands and cabarets, you get two markets to pull from there. material are you going to be planning on doing this week?
It's going to be a lot of standalone songs. I gig around pretty frequently and sort of have a collection of songs that just sort of exist unto themselves. You know, they're not part of any larger musical, but they all kind of feel like theater songs because they are. You know, they're all kind of short stories, and they're about characters and sort of take you on a little journey throughout the song. So we're going to be doing a bunch of those, some new stuff, some classic stuff, and a few songs from the musicals that you mentioned earlier, like Black Suits and Blood Song of Love. And it should be a good time. I have to go buy my kazoos for the show today.
How did the interest in Broadway start?
My interest in Broadway started when I was a little guy. I'm from Long Island, mm-hmm. and I went to see Little Shop of Horrors mm-hmm. for my sixth birthday. My dad mm-hmm. took me, and I was pretty much hooked from then on. And all throughout school, you know, elementary school and high school, I was total theater geek. I just loved musical theater. I was obsessed with Sondheim and Candor and Ebb, and I just loved it. You know, no one else in my family was really that into theater. I mean, everyone, you know, just liked it, but it was never a passion in the way it was for me. And it was just something I immediately responded to. And as soon as I was old enough to know that there were people who wrote the shows, that's what I wanted to do immediately.
When you say Sondheim and Candor and Ebb, that's a big step from Little Shop of Horrors. And do you remember how you fell into those two writers?
I feel like I'm always thankful that Little Shop of Horrors was the first show that I saw, because I still think it's a very incredible piece of theater. But I think that one of the things that I responded to as a little kid was the darkness of it, and uh-huh. and I loved that it was, you know, characters who were kind of sad, like they were funny but sad. So for me, it kind of felt like a natural progression to get into a lot of the Sondheim stuff, where it was, you know, obviously very dark, and you had characters that were sad, and, you know, stuff like Sweeney Todd is, I think, actually really, really easy for kids, for a certain type of kid to get into. You know, it's very exciting, and it's melodramatic, and there's, you know, murders and mistaken identity, and it's there's an element of fun to it. So between that and, you know, Into the Woods, it kind of felt like a natural, thing. You know, I think the second show that I saw was Anything Goes at Lincoln Center. So I'm always kind of happy that I started with Little Shop and then saw Anything Goes, because uh-huh. I think that, you know, I do love, you know, classic musical theater as well. But for me, the most exciting stuff is where those things kind of intersect, you know, the darker aspects and the more classic sound, which is what I think Candor and Ebb is.
All right. Now, when you say that you were a theater geek in high school, mm-hmm. does that mean you were performing?
By the time I got to high school, I was musical directing and playing piano. I performed a lot when I was younger, and I was in elementary school and middle school, just because when you're that young, that's sort of the only way you can participate in, you know, community theater and school theater. So I performed in things that I was terrible, and I knew I was terrible, and I was, you know, petrified to be in the shows. It totally scared me, but as much as it scared me, I still loved it. I still loved doing it, and for me, I just loved it. I loved being around the theater, you know, and I loved watching, like, directors and watching how the things were made, and, I knew I wasn't good at it, but I just loved it. I remember I did a performance of Two Lost Souls from uh-huh. Damn Yankees at a camp show. Yeah, when I was in sixth grade, and it was one of the worst performances anyone's ever given, ever.
We did a production once, and the guy who played Joe was terrific, but for some reason he could not get that harmony. Mm. And
oh, yeah.
It was unfortunate, because, you know, other than that, it was great. I'm not surprised to hear about your influences being so eclectic, because anyone who knows Joe's work knows he can write in many different styles and also meld them together, as he said. Blood Song of Love was really a terrific show. It was Ars Nova, wasn't it?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, I hope we see. Let me ask you, do you think mm-hmm. we'll see that show again? Is it being done elsewhere? What is the situation with that?
Yeah. I can say with a fair amount of certainty that we'll see it again. You know, it's a show that I'm very proud of it, and I had a great experience working on it, and I always feel like we weren't quite able to finish it. You know, so it's a show that I've been working on recently, and there's been some recent excitement in it. So I'm really crossing my fingers that that'll be on a stage somewhere in the next year, which I think it will. So.
We should mention, by the way, that Joe, it's not one night at 54 Below. He's there with his folks several nights, and it's so I guess we'll post the schedule on with the show notes.
Yes.
Yeah. We're doing all
a whole week, right? Yeah.
It's we're doing four shows spread out from tomorrow, April 15th, until May the 5th.
So, a lot
of opportunities to see it.
Joe, I noticed here that you've been nominated for two Drama Desk Awards, a Lortel, and you received the Ed Kleban Award. And as you quote here, several other fancy-sounding writing awards, which is great. So, aside from the number of shows that I mentioned before, you also have a section on your website called In Development. You have Be More Chill, The Hunter S. Thompson Project, and Annie Golden, Bounty Hunter Yo. So you're keeping very busy. I mean, you're going Be More Chill for Two Rivers all the way through The Hunter S. Thompson for La Jolla. So you are spread out all over. You have a lot of are you working with the same groups of people together? I see that you have different book writers on the different projects.
It's those are the three shows that I'm sort of working on, the new shows I'm working on right now. And yeah, they all have different collaborators and four different places, which has been exciting. And I write music and lyrics, and I also write books. So a lot of the stuff that I do, I end up. The initial writing is by myself, and then I collaborate with director and actors, and this has been exciting to write these things at the same time with different artists, and it obviously informs the way that I write, both musically and lyrically, and it's been good. It's a little hard to keep them all straight sometimes.
But. You ever mix your shows together? You find a melody leaking into one show that's from another show or something like that?
Sometimes. I mean, the three shows are very different worlds, and very different musical sounds. So I think that they all inform each other in a great way. But I haven't accidentally written Annie Golden into my musical that takes place in a high school.
And then about 2 weeks ago or so, your song, Broadway Here I Come, was featured on Smash. So what's that?
Yeah.
What's that like? Were your parents all excited? Were your friends and family?
They were, yes, everyone around me was very, very excited for it. It's cool. It's a very surreal thing because I've always, my bluest sky scenario is that something that I've written, that I care about ends up, being seen by a huge amount of people, which, in my mind, the sort of third book version of that is like Broadway, I love the idea of Broadway, and it would be, a dream to have someone play Broadway. So for me, that's always, the thing that's a big thing. So to have the song on the TV show, it's amazing, and it's great, but it's just sort of, it just feels strange. It's something that I can quite wrap my head around. But it's cool. It's very fun, and I think Jeremy Jordan did a great job singing the song on the show. And the funniest part is that my parents and a lot of the people around me they see the Jeremy Jordan character on that show as me because
wow.
he's the
angry young
writer
man. Angry young man,
right.
Of the theater, yes.
Yeah. So sometimes my friend Rob will email me and he's like, "Oh, you're a real jerk on Smash last night, stealing things and."
My parents always saw me as Joey on Friends. So
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing?
But so, Joe, did Smash happen rather quickly, or were you? Were you approached by them maybe when the show started as possibly writing for it, or did that come later?
I was it felt like an epically long amount of time, but I was approached by Josh Safran. He's the showrunner. He came up to me after a show actually in June, and it's just when they were starting to revamp for this season. And originally, I was talking about writing some stuff specifically for the show, but Josh had really loved Brother Here I Come. but didn't think that they would be able to necessarily get it on the episode. And he had written the episode with the song in mind, and for months it kind of went back and forth. And, you know, I've never worked in TV before, and there's just like so many hugely fancy people who have lots of opinions, so it feels like every decision, it just takes a freakish amount of people to okay it. So
sure.
For a while, it seemed like the song wasn't going to get on, and then they were filming the episode, and then I think it was just the sort of thing where nobody could decide on anything, so they're like, all right, fine, use that song. So it happened in a very strange way, but I'm happy that it did. So Broadway Here I Come was used on there, and then it's been on there a few times, and I think it was on last night again, too, which I haven't seen. But another one of my songs, the Goodbye Song, which was a previously written song that's also going to be used in a couple weeks.
It's amazing. You know, I might have called myself a theater geek when I was in high school as well, and our theater geeks weren't wildly popular, and so I wonder, do you go back to Starbucks in Garden City and see some old high school friends and say, hey, you know, hey, how's that going? you don't have to answer that.
It's not a huge thing for me, and also, I was a theater geek, but I don't feel like I was like a bullied kid. Yeah. You know, I was a lot fatter in high school and all throughout school. So like that was the thing when I was a kid. I was always like, you know, I was the fat kid who was picked last for dodgeball. But not in a really terrible way. Just I think in a way that a lot of fat kids are, made fun of a lot. So for me, my high school reunion. At a 5-year reunion, that was like the most fun thing ever, because I wasn't quite as fat as I was in high school, so that was great to go to. Be like, oh man, all the people who made fun of me are like fatter, you know, or having terrible lives. So that was nice.
I just noticed on the Facebook page for your show at 54 and below, 50 mm-hmm. below is that it's being produced by Jennifer Ashley Tepper. So
yeah.
You know, she's everywhere. I think there's actually three people: Jennifer, Ashley, and Tepper.
She's quite amazing. Yeah, she's my one of my greatest friends. I've known her for many years, and she's just the best. I love her.
She is, and certainly her love of Broadway matches yours and mine. So she's really a Broadway baby down to her tippy toes.
Jennifer has been a big supporter of Joe for years, and I just noticed her on Facebook lamenting the demise of Hands on a Hard Body, which I chimed in to agree mm-hmm. with that, mm-hmm. and I know Peter does too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Michael, you mentioned before that we started, you wanted to talk about Joe's play Blood Song of Love. Did you have something specific you wanted to ask about that?
Oh, I just wanted to bring up how it really was terrific, and I do hope that I see it again. It had a great cast. It was just so mm-hmm. well done, and it did, I think it was emblematic of Joe's work in that it kind of this melding of real classic musical theater writing with a newer, you know, rock sensibility type of thing.
And before we wrap up, I wanted to, I feel like I can't leave without mentioning the Joe Iconis Christmas Spectacular, which,
they've become famous.
It's become very famous. So, what was the genesis of this? How did it start?
It's, the Christmas Spectacular started because I've always just really loved. I love Christmas in general, but I've always loved the Christmas, you know, Christmas specials, and I love, you know, 80s Christmas specials, in particular the Pee Wee Playhouse Christmas special. It was always a favorite thing of mine. And so I always sort of had it in the back of my mind that, you know, one day I'd love to do some sort of Christmas special of my own. So it was, you know, it started in 2008, and I had a date at Ars Nova, and I was just going to do like a concert, and you know, I try my hand at it at a Christmas show, and it truly is just, it just ballooned from there, you know. In the first one, there was like 10 of us, and we, you know, had a couple characters, and there was a brief appearance by Santa Claus, and it just has sort of grown into this beast, year after year. And it's, I mean, nothing makes me happier, and I can't believe that it's a thing. You know, like this year, there's just so many people there, and, you know, we have a cast of like 50 at 54 Below, and Michael Cerber is singing songs, and I just have to pinch myself, and I can't believe that this is like a Christmas tradition that just came out of a love of this kind of thing, and now it's its own kind of thing. So,
well, for those,
I don't know, it continues to surprise me every year.
For those who are unfamiliar with it, I will put a link on our show page at BroadwayRadio.com to MrJoeIconis.com, which is Joe's website. And there in the other projects section, there is the Joe Iconis Christmas Spectacular, and there's videos with Jeremy Jordan and Molly Hager and a few others, and a big, looks like a production number at the end.
So
check it out, and it's a great, great thing. We're so excited to have you here, Joe. Let's just go over the dates again. I had them. Here they are. Monday, April 15th, 7 p.m. Saturday, 20th at 11 p.m. Friday, the 26th at 11 p.m. And Sunday, May 5th at 7 p.m. And get all that information at radio.com. We'll have a link back to all the other ways in which to reach Joe and check him out and stalk him. Joe, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll have you back again after your Broadway debut.
For sure. Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Have a good one.
Bye,
bye.
Joe.
Bye.
All right. Bye, boy.
But I'm not quite there yet. See, I've been brave in crazy weather. Drowning out my cries. I pull myself together. I'm focused on the prize. I'm falling, baby, through the sky.
So I'm so excited that Joe was able to join us. I really feel like Joe and Jennifer Ashley Tepper, they're really, it shows great for the future of Broadway, for young people that are so enthusiastic and so full of energy to be putting new works out there and reinventing what it means to be a Broadway baby. So next up, speaking of Broadway babies, we have... Matilda opened up this week. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that show that's come to us from across the pond?
It has come from across the pond. I saw it in London last year and love what it has to say, that we're living in an age where intellectualism and knowledge is not valued or appreciated, and we'd better do something about it. Well, Matilda is an awfully bright girl, but unfortunately she was born to stupid parents who prefer their son because he's just as stupid as they. The fact that she's so smart and she reads threatens them tremendously. So once again, who saves her? Librarians and teachers. They're our real heroes in our society. Now, before we start thinking this is a hagiography of the education system, let's also point out that the show does not treat administration very well. Not at all, in fact, because Miss Trunchbull is a terrible human being. She's the one who's running the school where Matilda goes, and she's horrific. Now, to ameliorate the fact that she's such a terrible human being, what has been done here, and was very successful in London, was having a man play Miss Trunchbull in that famous panto tradition that London musicals have done since time immemorial. Okay, fine. However, if you've seen the Matilda movie, which is a very good movie, a genuine woman played it there, and I thought it was just fine. I also like the fact that the Matilda movie Americanized the show, and I wish, much like the Full Monty, that this show had been Americanized. I find the accents very hard to understand, and I dare say I missed a great deal of the show. Late in the show, Matilda is asked to speak a foreign language. I'm not going to say any more than that. But frankly, I thought she was speaking English, and I just couldn't understand her again. So I do think that's a problem with the show, and I wonder if it's going to impact. Yes, great reviews, no question. The advance sale now is going to be monumental, yes. Probably a great many Tony Awards, including Best Musical. Yeah, sure. However, I just wonder how many people are going to come out of there saying, I couldn't understand what they were saying. So, and that's dangerous because Matilda does have a message worth hearing. It may not have the best score that Broadway has heard even in recent years. It's an acceptable one. I can't speak for the lyrics, of course, because I couldn't understand them. But nevertheless, musically, it's fine. No great achievement. But that little girl, how you love her for being so smart and being victimized that way and having people rescue her along the way. So Matilda has what most Broadway musicals used to have in abundance, and that is great heart. So for that reason, I like the show.
Michael, how did you feel?
Yeah, it's interesting. I checked some of the dates. I think Matilda was one of the first, if not the first, entertainment to kind of bring home that theme about how the importance of learning and books and language and, how wonderful it is to have a smart child. We've seen it in so many other recent entertainments. But I checked, for example, The Beauty and the Beast, the Disney film, that's a big point in that film, and I think that was not in the original story so much. But that film was 1991. Matilda, the novel, was written in 1988. We have currently on Broadway also, we have a Cinderella, which I, have said many times that I don't like, but there again, they try to, it seems shoehorned in to me, kind of in that case, that they make a point of Cinderella being very bookish. So, it's a very, very important and valuable theme. And it just, when it's used organically and not just kind of for a postmodern politically correct effect. But Matilda does it beautifully. It's the whole point of the show, I would say. And Peter referenced the importance of teachers and librarians. There was even a line, I can't remember the exact line now, but discussion of how much, whether teachers are paid well. And the teacher, Miss Honey, says, well, not really. it's just really criminal when you look at the relative salaries of teachers and people in other professions that really don't make any contribution to the world. It's just all about making money or whatever, or diversion. So that's one of the best things about the show. I think my quote on Matilda is going to be, I think it's a great show, but unfortunately I couldn't really be sure because it has the worst sound system I have ever heard in my life.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah, I do think it is much more that, Peter, because there were there not places where you could understand what people were saying?
I don't think that I ever really got a line where I understood every word.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, so. My general impression was that, first of all, it was much worse in the songs than in the dialogue. I would say I got 90% of the dialogue, but maybe only 40-30% of the lyrics, which is a very unfortunate,
sure,
degree. But in fact, I almost found myself waiting for the songs to end so that it would get back to a book scene where I could understand what people were saying. The sound for the record is by Simon Baker, whose previous credits include recent London and Broadway, Brief Encounter, La Bête, Boeing Boeing, The Norman Conquest, Closer, and the play What I Wrote. Significantly, none of those is a musical.
So I don't know. I mean, gosh, isn't that a shame that something like that, I really think it was that, because even Matilda, I mean, yes, the accent is something of an issue, but Peter and I saw the same performance and we saw the same Matilda, Millie Shapiro, who I thought was really wonderful overall, and she seems so authentically British, I have to say. I don't believe she is British, but she certainly seemed it. I got her dialogue. I just didn't get most of the lyrics. Another thing that didn't help the situation is, although I think the score overall was really quite terrific, And it also seemed like the sensibility of it really matched the sensibility of the Roald Dahl original. Music and lyrics by Tim Minchin. But there are not only a lot of false rhymes, but also a lot of false accents. And when you have both of those things, it can make for some pretty rough going. One of the worst ones that comes right at the beginning is Matilda sings I don't know what the whole line is, but she rhymes story and for me, you know, which again is not only not an exact rhyme, but the accent is off for the for me part of it. So I found that really too bad. And on top of all that, to me, the direction by Matthew Warchus was really not what I respond to. It was very, very, very over the top and cartoonish. A lot of yelling, a lot of screaming, a lot of gesticulating, a lot of really, really, really cartoonish performances, specifically by the two folks who play the parents of Matilda. And they are Leslie Margarita and Gabriel Ebert. Now, I understand, you know, and I agree that they should be cartoon villains rather than, you know, seriously scary, realistic villains. But I guess it's a question of degree. To me, it was so over the top that it wasn't remotely funny, especially the mother. She just was braying and screaming all night long, and I really, really did not find it amusing, and I didn't respond to it at all. What else did I want to say? I kind of feel like I think it's a great show, but it could have been so much better if it had been directed differently and if the sound issues had been addressed. And I find that very, very unfortunate that that something like that could could sabotage is the word I always use. I mean, it's not the correct word because I think sabotage means intentional.
Intention, yeah.
But when technical reasons like that do a show in, that's what I always think of. Oh, and I should mention on top of everything else that I got to the Schubert about 1:45, and there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people lined up, not even lined up, well, sort of lined, but more in a clump in Schubert Alley waiting to get in because there was some kind of a problem. So when we finally got in, when they started to let people in about 10 of, and when I finally got in, I asked one of the ushers and she said there was a sound problem. So I spoke with the house manager at intermission. I said, I understand there was a sound problem that prevented you from letting people in until 10 minutes before the showtime. And he said, yes, that's right. And I said, well, did it not occur to you that it might have been courteous to make an announcement to the audience, apologizing and explaining the reason for the delay? And he looked at me as if I had three heads. Like it never occurred to him to do that. So I don't know. I just see a big breakdown in professionalism and competence and treatment of the audience and professionalism. I don't know why they couldn't have taken the 15 seconds to make an apology and an explanation.
Well, this also suggests, too, that maybe they didn't lick the problem completely, and maybe that's why we had such a hard time hearing. Because when I saw Matilda in London last year, this wasn't an issue for me. Oh. Granted, the kid I saw was phenomenal beyond belief, and I understood everything she was saying. So you're right, maybe it's a sound issue, and maybe they just didn't lick it yesterday, and maybe future audiences won't have the problem that you and I had.
Maybe, except that I have been hearing that from
Okay, all right.
Saw the performances. So I just think that's really, really too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I heard that there were some other issues with technical roots at Matilda. So, you know, they have a pretty solid team there of people that know what they're doing. So maybe they will recognize this and fix it. And because certainly the box office for it is out of control. You can't get tickets to it. You can't get good tickets to it right now if you're, you know, it's ridiculous. It's April, but I'm telling you, if you're thinking about Christmas presents, buy them now.
The physical production is really quite extraordinary.
Sure is.
Just visually, it's amazing. And you know, Matilda has been, we've been waiting for it for quite some time. Wasn't the Schubert just sitting? Hasn't it been sitting empty?
Yeah.
And the marquee has been up for months and months. I'm not sure exactly what the delay was, but I thought that might have given them the opportunity to really fine tune the technical aspects, and certainly they did from a visual standpoint. But it's just, that's my impression of the sound, and it's a real shame.
All right, let's move on. Next up on the agenda is Motown the Musical. Peter got a chance to see it. So, Peter, what did you think about it?
Well, what's so interesting about Motown is here we have Berry Gordy on the scene to tell the story of what really happened when he started this company. And the story is so far less interesting than the one we get in Dreamgirls, which didn't have anybody from Motown on its staff to tell the story. I will admit, you got to give Berry Gordy credit for one thing. I mean, he may come across as this wonderful guy who only wanted to help people and then was betrayed by everybody who got bigger record deals. But still, a guy who admits that he went to bed with Diana Ross and couldn't get it up, you should pardon the expression, that's very interesting to me that he would want to tell people that and let people know that. I have no idea why, and we don't find out why, but nevertheless, that is a scene in the show. The biggest problem with Motown is the fact that there's an embarrassment of riches where the music is concerned. Berry Gordy is obviously in love with this music, as well he should be. I'm not criticizing the songs, but the problem is he just wants all of them in there. There are 50-plus songs, closer to 60, I think, in this show. And as a result, many of them are like 57 seconds, and they just don't have a chance to build. You've heard of coitus interruptus. What we get here is songus interruptus, because no sooner they start than they're over. I will tell you, the audience appreciated even hearing them on this small level, and the woos in the crowd really were heartfelt, though I have a feeling that if they had had a chance to really breathe and become the full songs that we know them to be, the audience response would have been even greater. Everybody in it is terrific. No problem there whatsoever. I'm really, really, very impressed by everybody I saw there. Most impressive, of course, as it should be for something like this. You want Brandon Victor Dixon, who's playing Berry Gordy, to be wonderful. He is. Felicia LeKay, terrific as Diana Ross. Charles Brown, who's Smokey Robinson, wonderful. Brian Terrell Clark, Marvin Gaye, sensational. However, the kid who's playing Michael Jackson, Raymond Luke Jr. is his name. Whoa! You know, and what's so impressive, too, is the fact that we see him a little earlier playing young Berry Gordy, and he doesn't have much to do. They have him play Little Stevie Wonder at one point, and they don't make anything of that. He just comes on, walks on, and it's no more than that. So it's very clever, the fact that you see this kid and he's not doing anything during the entire first act, and you just assume he doesn't have that much talent. I mean, you don't think about it that way, but you subconsciously saying, all right, the kid, they just picked up this kid off the street and he can, walk around. I mean, he doesn't have anything to do. But, oh, yes, he does in the second act, and he does it awfully well indeed. So, but otherwise, it's just a whole bunch of cliches, I'm sorry to say, including one of my least favorite things in the world that comes mostly from the world of movie musicals. A guy sits down at the piano, Berry Gordy, starts playing a song, gets rapturous while he sings it, and then stands up from the piano and sings, and an orchestra takes over, that type of thing. So that happens here, too. It's going to be a big hit because, really, there are enough baby boomers around who want to hear this music again and hear it in one place. But I'm telling you, this is not going to be a good cast album. I know there's already been one released that isn't a cast album, that just has the songs of Motown. And Michael, I remember way back when Moving Out happened, and I remember you saying about the cast album, why bother to buy a singing Billy Joel song? Billy Joel singing Billy Joel songs, you know, and this is more of an issue here, I think. So big hit, but a little boring for those of us who ask more about Broadway musicals than just the nostalgia of hearing old hits.
Well, I think I also said that about Mamma Mia, and then didn't that sell like 500 million? And also Jersey Boys. I mean, I may have said that about the albums, but they have all been extremely successful. So what do I know?
Well, speaking of what do I know is when we first talked about when Motown was first announced, the three of us had a little chat about it. And I basically said, oh, this will never sell a ticket. And Mr. Riedel wrote the other day that it's got a bigger advance than anything else on Broadway, including Matilda and Lucky Guy, that these tickets are very, very hard to get, and it's selling really well. So
now, James, why did you think that?
Why did I think? I didn't think that the Broadway audience would be engaged in wanting to see a show about Motown. I didn't think it would. I just didn't think it would engage the Broadway audience, but it seems that group ticket sales have been very brisk for this, and this is something that's very popular. It's interesting because you definitely on Broadway you have certain groups that you want to market to. You want to market to, you know, tourists, and you want to market to children, and you want to market to families and things like that. And right now in the children and family groups, you know, which had been dominated through the last couple of years by most Disney shows, we now have Cinderella and Annie and other types of things.
Matilda,
exactly. And people are saying, well, I don't know if we wonder which show is going to win. The thinking is that they all can't win because there's not enough big market for it. And that was the same sort of thing I felt for Motown, was that I didn't think there was a big enough market, but obviously I was wrong because tickets are really, really hard to come by.
I don't know.
Cafe. You know, I never expected Smokey Joe's Cafe to last as it did, and especially given that I didn't think it was a good show. It was funny because when Smokey Joe's Cafe came out, I wanted a book. I wanted to know what it was like for Lieber and Stoller, two white guys, to be dealing with this black market. I mean, African-American market as opposed to black market in the way that people mean black market in an illicit way. When they showed up at these offices, were they distrusted? Were they resented? What was the feeling there? But, you know, I have a feeling the book would have turned out to be something like the one we have for Motown, so it's all for the best that the Smokey Joe's Cafe just put one song after another. In a way, I wish Motown had done that. And I have a feeling that the audience would have had an even better time if it was just one song after the other.
You are the fourth person I've spoken to who said exactly the same thing, Peter.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen the show yet, but I wonder, you bring up an interesting point. Do you suppose that maybe for the cast album that they'll do full versions of the songs?
I wouldn't be a bit surprised. Yeah, I know Decca Broadway has been interested in doing the album, and whether or not they will say, come on, let's just do it. I mean, for example, I was writing recently, I haven't run it yet, a story about the Say Darling album. Say Darling was a 1958 comedy, not a musical, but you wouldn't know that from the cast album, because what it was about the production of a musical. And when Say Darling was actually done on Broadway, it was just done with two pianos, and you only heard snippets of songs. Suddenly, for the cast album, there was an overture, which wasn't in the show, totally orchestrated, you know, dozens of musicians, and songs were done completely, even though they weren't written to be done completely. So who knows, maybe Motown will follow in that lead.
Did I ever tell you I have one of my most prized possessions is the original cast album of Red, White, and Blaine, the musical from Waiting for Guffman.
Sure, yeah. most interesting. Good.
Unfortunately, in that case, there's not a whole lot more. I mean, the songs, even the full quote unquote versions,
are
quite short. But one last thing on Motown, and I'm half joking or 99% joking. I haven't seen it yet, but I was almost wondering if they would include anything from Pippin because the cast album was on.
I was kept on waiting for a reference to Pippin, even though I knew it wasn't coming. But yes, Motown did the cast album Pippin. Yes, indeed it did.
And of course, Pippin is now isn't it like across the street or something? Or
I was waiting all morning long for a reference to Pippin because I wanted to bring up the New York Pops tribute to Stephen Schwartz, which Michael got a chance to see. So, Michael, tell us about that. It was at Carnegie Hall on April 12th?
Yeah, it was quite an evening. You know, to hear an orchestra of that size, you know, as I always say, to play this kind of stuff, you just don't really get the chance to hear that very often, hardly ever. And, you know, things like Meadowlark, which Julia Murney sang and did a wonderful job with. But to hear that beautiful orchestration, you know, by 70 pieces or 75 pieces, maybe 80, it's transformative. It's superlative. There are no words for it. And there was a very good cross-section of Stephen Schwartz's work. My only, I guess, cavil was that there were so many showstoppers kind of front-loaded, I should say, towards the beginning of the concert. I mean, Jeremy Jordan sang Lost in the Wilderness, and that brought down the house, and that was immediately followed by Meadowlark. And that was immediately followed by West End Avenue, which Jennifer Laura Thompson sang. I guess Schwartz does have quite a few of those songs, but he also has a lot of, you know, more introspective, ballady kind of songs. I suppose they gave the balance to the showstoppers because of the kind of evening it is and the fact of having the huge orchestra there. But it was really terrific. The fourth singer was Norm Lewis, who unfortunately did not have a good night. I'm not sure what was happening, if it was lack of rehearsal or nerves. He kind of messed up rather majorly on a few occasions. When he was not having memory flubs, he sounded fantastic and looked great as he always did. But that was a little unfortunate. So hopefully that was just, you know, a momentary lapse. But it was a great night. There was an orchestral suite from Schwartz's opera, Seance on a Wet Afternoon, which I really loved, despite a lot of bad press from the musical press, who were, I guess, whenever they see an opera, a modern opera, they think it has to it can't be melodic and it has to be atonal, and if it's not, it's just so old fashioned, you know, which I think is a ridiculous opinion. But the music sounded as lovely as it did when I remembered seeing it at New York City Opera, Seance on a Wet Afternoon. No vocal selections from it, just orchestra, but really, really beautiful. And Jeremy sang, you know, he really, I think I mentioned this last week, and we were talking about him before in our talk with Joe Iconis. He really just really seems to be becoming a huge star.
Yes.
And mostly, you know, through his theater work. I mean, Smash didn't hurt. And now he's been announced for the film of the last 5 years. So that could really move him to a whole nother plane. But it's kind of like Kristen Chenoweth, I would say. Someone who basically is becoming very famous through their theater work, and then they do film and TV to kind of capitalize on that. But they're really creatures of the theater, the musical theater, and I think that's absolutely fantastic. The audience just really ate him up, and he was so professional, and he sounded phenomenal, and he just he seems like real major star material.
All righty. Well, that was a one night only thing, so I guess what do you know if it was recorded or anything like that?
Oh, I think they just do archival stuff.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point. These would be ideal for well, I hate to say it, but for bootlegs, because they're not, because they are not made available to the, you know, in recorded form to the public. I noticed a few, I think, cell phone videos, which, you know, I object to because of the annoying, annoying other patrons, but it's, you know, I guess nice to have some record of it.
So next up on our agenda, we were going to talk about the assembled parties, but I just noticed that it's really not open until the middle of next week. So let's hold off on that until next week. We'll talk about that next week, Peter, okay?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And maybe Michael will have seen it by then. Do you have it on your schedule, Michael, to see the assembled parties at the Friedman?
Yes, although I think it's not till... not till after that, but that's okay.
And okay.
Hopefully I'll get into Motown because I screwed up my invitation.
Okay.
Oh, and I'm going to be seeing Rigoletto at the Met. This is the production directed by Michael Mayer.
Oh, that's so, right. We mentioned that a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Next up, last week we spoke with Tom Hewitt and another Madea at the Duplex, and Michael got a chance to see it. So, Michael, give us a quick wrap-up on that before we head into news.
Oh, it was really a tour de force on, especially you know, on Tom's part. It's just a monologue, you know, a full-length monologue about this, you know, based on the Madea legend, and it's this actor who basically gives up his career to have a relationship with a very rich, very powerful businessman. And then is thrown over for a younger model, you know, which is basically what happens in Madea, except that, you know, with the, a lot of the genders reversed, and it's not, Madea is not a gay story, but here it is. And so Tom just really did an amazing job. And the thing, one of the most amazing things about it was that there is a lot of humor in the first part of the piece. And so people were laughing, but then I felt at the performance I attended that the laughter continued in appropriate moments, I guess, because people felt that they had been cued into, you know, to the humor part of it. But it took a while, but Tom did get everyone back, you know, and it becomes a very, very serious towards the end, as you might imagine, if you know anything about any version of Madea. So kudos to him, and also to Aaron Mark, who wrote the piece. Really, really quite extraordinary. I it'd be interesting to see what kind of a future life it has. You know, obviously it's limited in a sense that it's a one person show. It's not really quite full length for a, I suppose it was about an hour, maybe a little less. Really extraordinary how people can come up with fascinating new twists on these iconic, you know, legendary pieces of theater and mythology. When I walked in, they were playing the Maria Callas recording of the opera version of Madea. So I thought, oh, well, that's a good sign. That they've got me already on their good side. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I really recommend it if you can get to see it.
They had me at hello.
Exactly. it's at the Duplex now, and I think they have a few more. So if you can see it there, great. And if not, keep an eye out for it in the future.
All right. So next up on our news section, since we last spoke, I don't think we mentioned it last week, but Hands on a Hard Body was
We didn't know that yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So Hands on a Hard Body announced their closure, and they closed yesterday, which we mentioned during our talk with Joe. Any words about that you guys want to say?
I have a feeling this is going to be redeemed in regional theater.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see a lot of productions of this, and I won't be surprised if we see better productions of it, because I do think it can be improved with a different take on direction. And but I wish this show well, and I have a feeling that it's going to bring a lot of pleasure to a lot of people in the hinterlands.
All right.
Yeah, I agree with that. It seems Yeah, it's hard to explain exactly why, but it seems like it's not the kind of thing that Broadway currently responds to. It should be, but it's not. And it does seem, because of the community feel of these people going through this, I do agree with you, and I hope it's true that it will go over very well in the regions and in stock and things like that.
On other news, Nick Heitner is stepping down from the NT, the National Theatre in Britain.
I think that the History Boys was quite extraordinary. I think everyone would agree with that, and that was really an amazing achievement. So what else? I was always kind of mixed feelings about Nicholas Heitner Carousel.
Sure.
But he's done, he's certainly done a lot of great work. And I think the general feeling is that his stewardship of the company has been extremely successful.
Yes, it has been. No question about that. I saw Hamlet there that was really terrific, as well as Winter's Tale that was marvelous as well. I do feel that his direction of Sweet Smile's success hurt the show tremendously.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, what I have seen over there, and it hasn't been much, I certainly have seen a number of things that he hasn't directed, but they've been terrific productions, so he gets credit for that, for getting the right people in the right places. So... But as I understand it from what I've read, and that's basically what I have to go on, London is considering this a loss because they've enjoyed what he's put in front of them in the last decade.
All right.
And thank you for saying decade with the British pronunciation.
About the biggest news in the decade, right? Yeah, so I've never understood that. You know, is that because Rose just doesn't know how to say the word? I've often wondered if that's what that has meant, because that's the only place I've ever heard decayed in Gypsy.
Oh, so. I always thought it was just a wonderful way to indicate that indicate slightly that these songs that she has in her show for the kids are not that terrific.
yeah, that's the assumption I've reached. I've often wondered if at that time maybe people did say decayed. Like, for example, and I can get a few whole song. There's a song, When Gemini Meets Capricorn, and that's what they say, Gemini. And I remember talking to Richard Sibelico when he was doing his revival, and he says, my mother says Gemini, but everybody else says Gemini. So were people saying decade in the vaudeville era? For all I know, they did, but I do have a feeling it's the fact that Rose doesn't know the word and she just thinks that's how it's pronounced and it rhymes and good.
But that's so funny, because every it's funny you say that, Peter, because every time I listen to Gypsy and it gets to that lyric, to cite only one, she loves a man cow, a tan cow, who can cow her with a glance. And I think, I really don't think that kind of show would have that kind of brilliant lyric writing.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Yeah.
So, other news is that next year, Christmas Story is going to return for the holiday season, which we were hoping and wishing that it would. So, the Pasek and Paul production.
More important to me is that they get a nomination for Best Musical. I hope that
happens. I think that this article was strategically placed so that Tony nominators and voters would be aware that it is coming back. Yeah.
And I hope that, as several people have mentioned, I hope, and I'm sorry I can never remember his name, that wonderful kid who everyone loved in his tap dancing role. I hope he's not.
Well, it's funny, I thought of him when I saw Motown, because once again, here in the second act, there's a marvelous kid performance that you didn't see coming. So granted, this is more of a singing performance in Motown, but nevertheless, I thought, gee, the LaFontaine has seen two kids be astonishing in the second act of their musical.
Oh,
So good for them.
Well, anyway, I hope he's not too old to come back.
Right.
He's probably hoping that too. somebody who's not old to come back is Mary Louise Parker. She's coming back to Broadway in Snow Geese, which is a show written by Char White. We talked about Char a few months ago with The Other Place.
Yeah, and so I thought... Char's a man, right?
Yeah, Char's a man. Yeah. And so we... looking forward to that. And that's always great to have Mary Louise Parker come back to Broadway. I don't know if you guys know Jeff Buckley, the work from Jeff Buckley. Jeff Buckley passed away a number of years ago. So Jeff has a musical coming to the Old Globe based on Romeo and Juliet called The Last Goodbye. But Jeff is a very, very popular artist in popular music. And I, you know, coming into the Old Globe with Jeff Buckley as the writer and The Last Goodbye, I sort of feel like it's on our radar screen. It might show up in the future. Something that we're hoping is going to show up in the future is Tuck Everlasting, but it was postponed. It seems like they have a real estate problem. They can't get to find the right theater for them on Broadway, and so they have put the production on hold. And that's what they are.
This may sound bizarre, but nevertheless, I was in Boston a couple of weeks ago, and I saw a reference to this because it was going to play the Emerson Colonial Theater, I should point out. That's what it's called now, because Emerson has rescued it. Anyway, and I thought, gee, I wonder how long it'll be before they cancel the out-of-town tryout, because Boston has had so many of these shows announced, and then they cancel, because the out-of-town tryout system for Boston, anyway, is truly dead, I'm sorry to say. And as somebody who saw everything there from I Get It Via Wholesale to Funny Girl to Good Time Charlie, believe me, to Holly Golightly, for that matter, I feel bad that that's the case. But Boston just doesn't get tryouts anymore. Seattle and Chicago does. And they've earned them, you know, because business is good when that happens. And when tryouts do come to Boston, like Seussical and High Fidelity, they don't do business because Boston is just another town where people say, I never heard of that, and don't go. So, but I it was days before the announcement was made that Tuck Everlasting admittedly wasn't happening, period. Not just that it had canceled its pre-Broadway tryout. But, yeah, too bad.
I do hate to, you know, one hates to be cynical, but it just sounds like, is it really because they don't have a Broadway theater?
Yeah, really.
First of all, we don't know what theaters will be available then.
Yeah, you know, that was my thought as well, is that
that's the official explanation and spin. Yeah, so
and it was to have been Casey Nicholaw directing, who's one of my absolute favorites. So that was definitely something that made me excited about it. And Andrew Keenan Bolger, you know, who's terrific, was going to be, was he going to be Tuck? I don't know the piece.
I would think so.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Just because he's done supporting roles and now it's time for him to move up. So right. I would have guessed that, yes.
So that's too bad.
All righty. So that's about it for this week.
Well, can I say something?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's been a bit of confusion about a column I wrote last week. A lot of people are taking it at face value. And I'd like to point out that it's really a joke. I talk about a guy who won the recent search for the reality show that was called Looking for Mr. Good Time for the upcoming revival of Good Time Charlie. None of this is true. I just wanted to write a parody of a Playbill bio. That was my so I talked about this guy named Walter Plinge, and I don't know if you know that Walter Plinge is essentially the George Spelvin of London. That's the term that you don't use their name or don't want to use their name. So I talked about him doing a CD of it that's available on WP Records, and that he played in the orchestra when they made the soundtrack to Wicked, and things like that, that he appeared in Dewey Defeats Truman, the musical that told of Mr. Capote's flunking out of library school, Dewey Defeats Truman, you know, things like that. And it's just a long, rambling bio of somebody talking about that when he got a subscription to a theater as a tribute to his favorite movie, Star Wars, he alternated between seats R2 and D2, you know, so things like this. And that he appeared in children's productions like The Selfish Shellfish, The Antelope Who Loved Cantaloupe, and Caballo, which is Latin for pony. That's the children's music version of Equus. So it's a goof. It's a joke. But it's amazing to me how many people are saying, I didn't know there was going to be a revival of Good Time Charlie. And it even showed up in all that chat. So anyway, don't take it seriously. And look up the column. I think you'll get a few laughs out of it.
Oh, as long as we're setting the record straight, can I just take a few minutes to correct some two misspeeches that I made 2 weeks ago, actually. We were talking about the wonderful tact production of Happy Birthday, the Anita Loose play, and I kept referring to Jenny Bacon in the lead, but it was actually Mary Bacon. And I guess my excuse is that Jenny Bacon, who's another wonderful actress, was just recently on stage in My Name is Asher Lev. So sorry about that. And I especially wanted to correct it because Mary Bacon was terrific in Happy Birthday, as Peter agrees with me. So I felt sorry about that. And also, this is so weird. We're talking about last 5 years, which always bears bringing up again, because again, I think it's one of the greatest things I've ever seen, this production at Second Stage. And I refer to Jamie as a publisher, but of course he's a writer. I mean, he's a novelist, he's a writer. He's not a publisher. We were talking about the publishing world, and I think that's why I said that. So forgive us, and me specifically, please. We sometimes do make little flubs because we're talking off the cuff here, and we don't necessarily spend a lot of time going back editing and fixing things. So please forgive.
What Peter and Michael might not know is that every week I put out our 2-hour podcast correcting all the mistakes that I make, but I do that separately because it usually takes about 2 hours to correct all the things that I stay in 1 hour. So yeah, we understand that. So anyway, anything coming up for you guys that you want to mention coming up this week, that, or should we just stay tuned for next week?
Let's stay tuned for next week.
Alrighty. Yes. So I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. That way there's a subscribe button, and every time that we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to subscribe in iTunes, you can subscribe by Stitcher, which is an app for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and get it streamed to you right away. You could also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you do listen to us on iTunes, or maybe even if you don't listen to us on iTunes, please go to iTunes and leave us a review, because those reviews help Apple rank us higher in the Broadway category and will help other people find the shows and listen to us as well. You can find contact information for Peter, Michael, and me on BroadwayRadio.com, and touch base with us. Let us know what you think about what we're doing here. There's phone numbers, email addresses, Twitters, and Facebook links and things like that. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.